This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Newspaper readers in Greensboro have come to know and appreciate Susan Ladd's work for nearly 35 years. She began in the 80s as a reporter for the News and Record and worked her way up to features editor, senior writer, and columnist. We've spoken to her a number of times on this show for news updates from the Triad. As a columnist, she's written moving pieces about the lives of the many people on her beat. Perhaps none was as touching as the Father's Day column she wrote about being disowned by her father for marrying a black man. And then her farewell column in February, announcing that she'd been laid off as part of the downsizing at the News and Record. Joining us now to tell us the stories behind the column is journalist and educator Susan Ladd. Welcome back, Susan. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Tell us about growing up in Durham County, right? North of the city.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. North Durham. Well, it was, we were very working class. My dad, when I was very young, drove a truck for Pilot Freight Carriers. We grew our own food in this massive garden, and my mom would can and freeze every summer. And we worked in the garden from the time we were little kids. We played baseball in the front yard with trees as bases, a dangerous enterprise in many ways.
Yeah. But
it was very, very rural and in some ways very wonderful.
Did you get downtown and enjoy the sweet scent of Durham?
For me, downtown Durham will always be the smell of sweet cured tobacco. It permeated downtown when I was growing up, and it was, you know, part of my life. My grandfather worked at American Tobacco for many, many years. One of my aunts worked at Leggett Myers. And, tobacco is a big part of my dad's father was a tobacco farmer. So we were sort of on both ends of the whole cigarette industry.
See, you got a little bit of that. There's some people working in the factories, and you say big garden and a lot of homespun clothing and food. Mm-hmm. In fact, you even had to process your own chickens, didn't you?
That was one of the worst jobs we ever had. If you've ever plucked a chicken, it is the nastiest job on earth. The smell stays on your hands for hours.
Because you have to, right? I mean, describe it for us.
First somebody, not me, wrings the chicken's neck and cuts it off. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure they did cut it off first. And then you hold the chicken by its grimy feet and dip it into a big boiling pot of water. This was done outside, thank God. Mm-hmm. And so dirty chicken feathers, and then you pull the because the boiling water loosens the feathers, and you pull the feathers out. Nasty.
Yeah, unless you think this is like a sweet scent of chicken stock wafting through the air.
No.
Not by a long shot.
It was hideous.
So this is part of the growing up and the experience. The other part, because now we're talking about late 60s, early 70s, mm-hmm. is that desegregation is underway, albeit slowly in this
very
part
slowly
of the world.
Very slowly in Durham County.
But it finally happened. So talk about what happened then.
Well, it was 1970 before the Durham County schools integrated, and they did it in the worst way possible, midway through a school year. And so we were at our regular schools until Christmas break, and after Christmas break, we were coming back to a different school. And in my case, I'd been going to Mangum School, which is way out in the country. And on the way to Mangum, we rode past Little River Elementary School, which was the school for black kids. And that was going to be our new school. My father was not about to have any of that. And so instead sent me and my little sister, who I think was in the first grade then, to this place called Council Christian Academy, which honestly looked like it had gone up overnight, cinder block on red clay. I don't know if the teachers were certified, but it was a white flight school is what it was.
Right. This was part of the massive resistance, the construction, quick, hasty construction of so-called private schools and academies that would then be outside of the law and outside of the court order. And that's what happened in the immediate aftermath in many places.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was funny. I mean, I was actually terrified by the idea of going to the black school because I had always been taught that black people were dirty and scary and dangerous. And so just it was just this huge looming unknown. What would it look like and what would happen to me there? But I would have gone, but it wasn't my decision by any means. And so after Christmas break, I went to Council Christian Academy. And that semester it changed my life.
How so?
Well, most of the kids there were nice. They were country kids, you know, not that different from me. But there was one kid who bragged that his dad was a high official in the Klan, and he was the worst kind of bully. And he was just this blustery, bullying guy, but bullies do attract a certain amount of people. And so he had his little group. And my best friend was named Anne, and, you know, I was short and dark-haired. She was tall and blonde and pretty. I was good at schoolwork. She wasn't. But she was very kind, and I was very fond of her. And one day, now, you have to understand, cheating was rampant in the school because the teachers didn't care.
Cheating was rampant.
Yeah. Everybody was looking at each other's papers all the time. I didn't, just because I tend to have, there's just some things for me that.
Well, if you're the smartest kid in the class, why would you look at their paper, right? Come on, Susan, you're smart.
Yeah, I was smart, but I just, it didn't sit right with me. But anyway, so one day he started talking about the fact that she had cheated on a test, and big deal, right? Except he just kept on and he kept on, and then at recess, Ann and I were walking, you know, one of these, it really was a sad affair, recess. I don't think there was any equipment. It was just red clay and gravel, and he started coming toward us and just was drawing people into this group, chanting, "Ann Yates cheats, Ann Yates cheats." And he just sort of drew people in like a magnet, right, until this huge group of people were following us around, chanting. And it looked like a mob to me.
What grade are you in at this time?
Sixth grade.
Yeah.
And she was stunned. I just, tears starting in her eyes. And I was stunned too, but I was also mad. That was my default response to things like that. And we tried to walk away and they followed us. And I looked around for some authority figure to intervene, and there was none. And as she was getting more upset, and I just took her by the hand and I said, "We're leaving." And I walked, to the building and went to the office and said, "Call our parents. We're going home." And I don't know why the receptionist did it. I don't know, maybe it was how upset we both were, Anne crying and me angry. And I just remember thinking, I'm not one of these people. I'm never going to be one of these people. And for me, I don't know, in my mind, I made the connection with Nazis and racists and anyone who others someone else.
Well, it's interesting that you would do that. There's a lot to unpack in this story, but let's stick with that part because it's not necessarily intuitive that you would pull all those things together. That's a kind of metacognitive skill there, where you have to be hovering very far above the picture to connect his bullying, his insecurity, which and that's what racism and white supremacy is. It's fear, it's insecurity, and it's usually incompetence. Yeah. All of that wrapped up, that's what generates this stuff and the mob. You were sixth grade. How did you put all that together?
Well, I was always questioning things from the time I was very young. I was always questioning things. I was measuring what I was taught against what I saw with my own eyes. And I always did that. My aunt used to joke about, you know, how even when I was young, I was up on my soapbox, you know, talking about what was right and wrong. And but yeah, I mean, I had sort of already, I think, either made or started to make the whole, you know, to really contest sexism, because my dad was a huge sexist too. And I remember noticing one day that he said, just like a woman and just like a N-word, in exactly the same way, the same vocal inflection, the same cruel, mocking tone of voice. And I began to see that these were things of that were alike. And so I had already sort of begun connecting those dots.
Well, we'll find out what happened when more of those dots were connected, leading to a career in journalism and more. For Susan Ladd, our guest today, a fixture at the Greensboro News and Record for 34 years, and my guest on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Susan Ladd, who worked at the Greensboro News and Record for more than three decades. Her story begins in a little house on Roxborough Road in North Durham County, with a mother who handmade their clothes and a dad who struggled to support Susan and her three sisters, who would not have you go to the black school after desegregation. And you weren't going to stay there much longer after a bullying episode. And you had connected the dots between the kind of bullying behavior that you and a girlfriend, the girlfriend in particular, was the target, and racism and sexism at the tender age of, what would that be, 11 years old or so.
Yeah.
So what did you do next? You go home. What did you talk about this experience?
I did. And when my mom came to pick me up, I was trying to describe it to her. And I learned something about grown-ups, because my mom is just wonderful, compassionate, you know, but she was sympathetic, but she didn't quite get it. And I think it's very hard for adults to accept that children can be evil, but I think that they can. I think I saw it that day. And, you know, to call it a mob, just never, she just couldn't imagine children being a mob, but that's what they were.
Were you talking about some of these other larger thoughts that you were having as well, connecting these dots, or was that not part of that conversation?
Not part of that conversation. I kept a lot of this in my own head for a long time. And because we weren't allowed to do a whole lot, I read a tremendous amount. And I started working these things out long before I ever started talking about them.
Let's talk a little bit more about your family. Your dad, you talked about him driving truck for a while, having to support that family. It was difficult, but eventually he became pretty successful, the quintessential self-made man, you would say?
Absolutely. I can't remember how old I was when he started a trucking company. He started with like one small truck or two and built it into quite a successful enterprise. It was David Ladd Trucking. He hauled gravel out of Nellatier Quarry for years and years and years, and did build it into very successful.
And what was your relationship like in those years as you started to get older?
My dad was, a lot of the qualities that made him a good businessman made him very hard to live with. He was very authoritarian, even dictatorial. He was very mercurial. He was given to terrifying rages. We didn't know it then. What we know now is that he was bipolar, and he was only diagnosed in the last couple of years, but this has been going on throughout his whole life. And the trucking company did very well, but it was a lot of pressure too, and he drank, and when he drank, it got a lot worse, and all these things started to sort of worsen as I got older, and it was a very scary way to live.
Difficult for your mother, of course.
My mom saved us in about every way you can be saved. When he would put us down, she would build us up. She was always there to tell us that we were smart and beautiful and we could do or be anything we wanted to be. When the message from him was, you're dumb, you're lazy, you're fat, you'll never amount to anything. And I don't know, some people think the way to build people up is to tear them down, but it doesn't really work. Fortunately, my mom had more credibility than he did.
This I think, gets into the terrible complexity of the psychology, the sociology, and the sociopathology of. I mean, we can talk about racism and white supremacy, but the way it commingles with these other psychiatric disorders, and who knows what he was through, all of this together.
Yes.
And as you try to explain, now you're seeing the big picture. This is part of a matrix. This is not just what, you know, this is not just one angry man, Mom. Yeah. This is part of a, how did she receive that?
She always changed more with the times than he did. Mm. She was someone who evolved, who had an open mind and an open, more importantly, an open heart. Mm. And so, but there was only so much you could do or say unless you wanted to get a butt kicking. So, I tended to be the defiant one, though. I mean, he was very authoritarian, and I just couldn't back down. And I paid for it many times in tears and punishment and humiliation, but I just was just natured that way. And he was not used to defiance.
That obstinate nature and refusal to back down in the face of authority could qualify you as a journalist.
It really did work well together, yeah.
Yeah.
Even I think about all the stuff that was going on, you know, in my latter years of junior high and high school, and Vietnam was still going on for what seemed like forever, and you know, the civil rights movement, the women's movement. And I became vocal about sexism a long time before I became vocal about racism. And the world was changing, and I was changing with it.
You went to UNC journalism. You majored in journalism,
yes,
at UNC, right?
Yes, yes.
So what were your plans? What was your vision for yourself then?
I was always a writer. I mean, from the time I could pick up a pencil, I think I wrote my first fiction story in third grade. It was about a dinosaur. I wrote poems. I wrote all kinds of things. I started writing for the junior high, you know, newsletter. I think it was more like a literary magazine, high school newspaper. I wrote funny columns. But I wanted to right wrongs. I mean, for me, I grew up in the Watergate era, you know, although it was very fresh. And to me, this was a noble profession. You know, this was a place you could go to write about the things that bothered me about the world, to help defend the underdog and to, again, to try to make things right. And I was all about fairness, right and fair.
Those used to be American virtues.
Yeah.
We used to celebrate those.
Funny thing that.
You graduated from college. You worked in Fayetteville, the Fayetteville Times, right?
Yeah, that was my first death. That was my first job. Wonderful job. It was still a two-newspaper town, and they were owned by the same family, but in the same building. There was literally a reception desk that sort of spanned the entrances to the two newsrooms, but we were just maniacally competitive at the same time. And that's something that, has been lost. It was a small, scrappy staff. We were all very excited about what we were doing.
What kind of stories were you writing?
Well, I was doing features at that time. I really started in feature writing, and I wrote about gravediggers, and I got to interview Loretta Lynn in person and Vincent Price in person, which was one of the greatest experiences of my life. And it taught me a lot, too, because I was just a maniac researcher. And what I learned very quickly about famous people is they've been asked so the same question so many times. And so it was my mission to find something to ask them about that they had never been asked about or rarely. And
All right. So what did you ask either Loretta Lynn? It was a while ago, so I'll give you a chance to think about this one. Which were the stumpers for either both of them?
I can tell you immediately. Yeah. The Vincent Price experience was terrific. I always loved those old horror movies, so I'd watched them all. I was a huge fan of his. But before he came, I knew he was coming to Pembroke University, and I read his autobiography, and he's like a Renaissance man. He was like a gourmet chef. He was an art collector. He was a very cultured and an intelligent man. And so I was at this press conference situation with you know, local newspapers and radio stations. And I think the first question I asked him about was, I knew he liked Native American art. And I asked him, we're in Pembroke, you know, have you looked at any Lumbee art while you were here? And he paused for a minute and he looked at me. And he answered my question. Of course, the other reporters will look at me like I have lobsters growing out of my ears because they're like, what are you talking about? And then I asked him, I can't remember the other thing. It was another interest of his that I asked him about. And again, he really looked at me and answered the question. And like I said, the other reporters are like rolling their eyes. But after the press conference, you know, I came up to just shake his hand, and he had huge hands. So my hand disappears up to the elbow. He's shaking my hand, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, thanks for the great questions. And I mean, it was the most wonderful moment of my journalism career in many ways, but it taught me that it pays to do as much research as you can and really push to be able to ask questions people haven't heard before.
Had he looked at Lumbee art?
He had heard about it. He had heard about it, but you should have seen the look on his face. It's
priceless.
No,
I can imagine. He's like, you know, he's not expecting that. He wants to hear about, you know, Theater of Blood one more time.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Did you really cook a dog in that, or was that just probably not, right? Yeah. Good for you. News and Records. So talk about getting that job. When did you start there?
I started the News and Record in January 20th, 1984. It was 20th, 23rd, something like that. Can't believe I remember that. But and I came as a feature writer. Started out, I was reviewing concerts. I was reviewing movies. And at the time, the Greensboro Coliseum was the largest music venue in the state of North Carolina, and was for many years. So all the big shows came through there, which was great. But a lot of bad shows came through there.
Did you tell it like it was?
Yes, yeah. I did. And I was pretty sassy. And, you know, I was not afraid to. It's funny because I'm teaching an opinion writing class right now. And I was, you know, we were looking at, okay, one of the dangers is you fall into the cheap shot, you know, clever line. And I remember that my headline for the movie review of Xanadu, which the masterpiece with Olivia Newton-John and I can't remember who else, was Neon Garbage on Skates.
That wasn't John Travolta, too, was it?
Yeah.
Was he in them?
No. Gene Kelly. It was horrible. Horrible. My heart went out to him.
So you didn't succumb to the temptation. You come up with a great line, but you don't really feel that way. But you would not use the great line.
No. I was terrible about doing that. I was savage as a reviewer in my younger years. But I think you have to be careful about that. You can get carried away with your clever prose and not be fair. And that's something that I learned.
Were you imagining? I mean, did that all make you happy, or were you imagining this as a stepping stone? Where were you in that moment?
I loved writing features. Yeah. I loved writing features because it allowed me to. I went skydiving on the job. I went scuba diving on the job. It was like you know, give a decision, she'll do anything. But I mostly enjoyed making introductions, is the way I looked at it. It was taking people to places that they could not go themselves, helping them meet people they would not normally meet. And that's what I loved about it. I didn't have any great burning desire to go into news for many, many years. But when I did, I really enjoyed doing that.
I
became a news editor first.
We'll talk more about editors. I've got lots of opinions about them. But let me talk about meeting people and introducing people. You got to meet someone who you might not have met otherwise. You meet a guy named Herb.
I did. Found him at work. he came to work at the paper. I guess it was 93 or 94 maybe. And we both loved computers and technology, particularly Apple computers. And when he found out that my sister was an actual Apple employee, I was, you know, I took on some kind of really special status.
Do you have a sister at home? He said, no, go ahead.
But we became friends, you know, and in those days, there were a lot of young single people. We hung out together a lot with the ball games and you know, all kinds of things like that.
Eventually, you got married.
We did. And that was, having black friends was no big deal, but.
Because we haven't said yet, Herb is African American.
He is.
Yeah.
But having a romantic relationship with someone of another race was just outside my realm of experience. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned looking back is, you know, you think you've dealt with your racist, you know, you've rejected all that stuff. But the closer that you get, the more you discover how much of it is still in your head. And so it was a very difficult step for me to take. We both had these feelings for each other, and I tried to deny it for a long time. And I really had to confront, you know, a lot of difficult issues.
Take us through that. What is that like? We've already established the fact that you're someone who gets the problem of racism. You've already struggled against it in many ways in the abstract. You have resisted your father at your peril and at your expense, right? So you get it. You've paid a price as a white person. And now you're actually conflicted about this relationship. How does it manifest? What's going through your head?
Well, you think you've shed all this stuff, and then you find yourself saying or thinking internally, nice white girls don't date black men. Only crackheads and whores do that. I mean, literally, this is the stuff I was taught growing up, and you just think it's not there anymore until you are in the moment, and suddenly. And I'm going, whoa, wait a minute. You don't believe this, do you? And I also knew there would be trouble in my family. And so I did a lot of soul searching. And I just, one night, I've got to decide what I'm going to do about this. And I thought about the most bedrock beliefs that I have, and I'm not a church goer. I cuss like a sailor, but I do have very deep beliefs about what is right and what is wrong. And I just pictured myself standing before the pearly gates and trying to explain to God that I had rejected the man that I'd waited all my life for because of his skin color. And I couldn't, it was like, no, I don't care what society says. In my gauge of what is right and wrong, this is not wrong. And once I got to that place, I was unassailable. I'd been very worried about attitudes and looks and all these things before. What would people say? What would people do? And after that soul searching that I did, I just was unassailable.
Had you and Herb been talking this over?
Yeah. I mean, I told him from the start that my family would never accept it. And he said, I would never ask you to choose between me and your family. I care about you, and I want to have a relationship with you on whatever terms you feel comfortable. Well, how can you not love that man?
You did, and we will talk about that relationship and the impact it had on you and your family when my conversation with journalist and educator Susan Ladd continues on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to journalist and educator Susan Ladd, who worked her way up from reporter at the News and Record in Greensboro to columnist and spent more than three decades there. We talked about meeting Herb, also at the News and Record. You're going through some of your own internal turmoil about what it would mean to marry him, and you made the decision. What was the impact on your family? What happened next?
Well, I told my parents had been divorced for quite some time by this point, and I told my mother first, and she was shocked, and I think concerned for me. But she would never turn her back on me, and I knew that. It was terrifying to think about telling my dad because I actually thought he might have a violent reaction, and I chose to tell him over the phone. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was the Christmas of 1995. And when we got together for Christmas, I had an engagement ring on. And I told him that Herb was from Delaware, that he worked with computers, that, you know, I told him all the almost everything about Herb except that. And I called him the next day or a day or two later, and I said, look, there's something else you need to know about Herb. He's black. And there was a silence, and he said, are you sure about this? And I said, yes. And he said, will you just let me know what I need to do and where I need to be? And I said, thank you, Daddy. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I couldn't believe that he was going to accept it, maybe walk me down the aisle. But of course, when he got off the phone, he immediately freaked out, and he started calling my sisters, and he called my mom. It's like, we've got to stop this. We got to talk her out of it. And you know, they were like, she's a grown woman. You know, she's in love. And he decided that it was something he couldn't accept. And I knew this before he told me himself, because my sisters and my mom. But he sent me a letter, and it said, if you do this, I don't want to have anything to do with you or any children you might have. And he enclosed a newspaper clipping about biracial kids and how they didn't fit in anywhere. And it was hard, but I was more prepared for that than what he said during the phone call, but it was still awful. And lots of people weren't comfortable with it. My mom's family wasn't comfortable with it. But my sisters and my mom stood by me as I knew they would. All our friends, in Greensboro, you know, were obviously supportive. But I ultimately decided that I just couldn't face a wedding where I looked out and saw people who were not happy. And so we decided to get married on a dive trip. We were going on a dive trip, and we got married in Turks and Caicos. What we planned was we would get married on the trip, but we would have a big party when we came back, and we would invite everyone, and it would be up to them whether or not they wanted to come. And one my friend Cindy Burnham, photographer, took this beautiful picture of our hands together, and that was the cover of the front of the invitation to the party. And one of my uncles sent it back. It had been crumpled up and then stretched out again, and he wrote, "This is the ugliest picture I've ever seen. You must be crazy. How could you do this to your mother?" And that was a body blow.
Yeah, and again, and to some extent, as you said, you were prepared in some ways. I mean, it didn't come as a surprise, and yet, when you see that.
Yeah, it's just the reality of it is hard. And so a lot of people on my mom's side of the family weren't accepting of it. My dad didn't have many people left. My great aunt, his aunt, actually drove over from Winston-Salem to attend the reception and told my mom, as an aside, that she thought my father was being a complete fool about the whole thing. You just never know. You can't just think a certain generation that everybody's going to think the same way.
Sadly, you had another aunt on your mother's side who was not so accepting, and that had real devastating impact on you.
Yeah. My grandmother lived with her, and so I felt like I couldn't go see her anymore. I didn't feel welcome. And when my grandmother died, it really broke my heart. And I asked my mom if I could come to the funeral, and she's like, "Of course you can come to the funeral. You don't have to ask." And when I did, it was funny, you know, some of them acted like nothing ever happened. And others went out of their way to say to me, "I don't have a problem with this. You can come to my house."
What was that like?
Anytime.
Was that, you mean, again, you go in with all of this anticipation and trepidation, I would guess, to hear at least some people saying.
Incredibly stressful. And I didn't feel like I could bring Herb with me or the kids. And it's just strange, you know, to have people who you know have said and done things, you know, just to act like nothing happened. I did appreciate the ones who made a point to say, "Look, I don't have a problem with this."
People were saying your father would get over it, but you knew better.
I knew better. He's as stubborn as I am, and just very entrenched in those beliefs. And so, I mean, people kept saying, "Oh, when the children come, you know, he'll get over it." And I was like, you know, I don't think so. And so,
well, you think about the depth of it. Forgive me for interrupting this, but you know, getting back to that picture of yours, here are these two hands bound in love. And when you think about the Jesse Helms campaign and the viciousness of that racist campaign, but the power of it, the maniacal evil genius of using that to win votes.
Yep.
Because you know that there are men out there, men and women out there, who will crumple up that was precisely.
Yep.
And so they're in the heads of the most evil, depraved instinct in humankind, and they prey on that to win votes.
Jesse was like a member of the family when I was growing up. I mean, when he was a commentator.
Yeah.
On
WRAL.
WRAL. Mm-hmm. My dad would always listen. The news was, you know, he'd be listening to this. I mean, literally, at this point, Helms is saying, "Send it back to Africa," you know.
Every night on the TV.
Yeah, and I mean, people called him Jesse like he was a member of the family. You know, it was not Senator Helms, it was Jesse.
Interestingly enough, now your father has cut you off. You know darn well he means it, despite the efforts by people in your family to maybe appease you. You kept the channels open. You kept sending him cards.
I did for many years. I talked with a friend about it, and you know, about how to deal. You know, just how you deal with this, and it started with the whole invitations to the reception, and she said, "You do the right thing, and let them decide what they're going to do," and it was very powerful. And I can't say that I wasn't angry with him, sometimes over all those long years. But I did for years send Christmas cards. When the kids came, I sent pictures of the kids. I sent Father's Day cards until it was just impossible to pick out something that felt authentic. And I guess it was about 10 years in that I knew I had to live my life, and I just sort of tucked it away somewhere that I could live with it. And then I just had this thought that the next time I saw him, he would be in a coffin, and I just fell apart. It was like falling down a well of icy cold water and not being able to climb back up, not being able to break the surface. And that was hard. And I really tried. I made a concerted effort to try to reestablish contact. I sent him a Christmas card, and I said, 10 years is too long to go without seeing someone you love. I would love to see you in any context you feel comfortable. And he never replied. It was hard.
That context did present itself, though, in the form of a wedding, right?
It did. Again, there was a point at which he got sick and he was about to have surgery, and I tried to go see him and was turned away. And that just about broke me. And I that was when I just decided I couldn't hope for this anymore. The hope was corrosive. It was cruel, and it was hurting me. And I still wanted to see him, but I knew I had to live my life. I had kids. But then in 2014, my niece got married. This was just one of the few occasions where we couldn't avoid,
Yeah.
I mean, I would sometimes make arrangements to accommodate him, and he would not come if I was going to be there and things like that. But this was, and he knew I was coming, and he coming anyway, and so there was huge anticipation before this about what would happen. Would he be nasty? Would he be friendly? And what to expect. And my youngest daughter was beside herself with anxiety about it. She cried the entire way to Wilmington, which is where the wedding was. Mm-hmm. But in the end, he walked in and he looked at me and he said, "Hey, sweetie." And I went over and hugged him and I whispered in his ear, "I love you, Daddy. I never stopped loving you." And he said, "I never stopped loving you either." And I get chills still when I think about that moment. And that was the beginning of us having a relationship again.
And it was a good 2-year relationship. He has since he's begun to suffer from some dementia, but there were two
solid
years.
Yeah,
we had
even then it took us a while to really know how to get together, I guess it was 2016 was the first Father's Day that I actually spent with him, and that's when we really started seeing each other more. And we did have these 2 years where he was the father that we always wanted. He was happy, and he could go out and have fun with us. He was actually.
And forgive me for interrupting again, but did us include Herb? And how is Herb dealing with all of this whole time?
He is an amazing man. I don't know how, but he really never took it personally. He never did. My dad never even met him, until that wedding. And so he hated that it hurt me, but he was never angry about it. And that's what made it bearable. If I'd had to manage, his anger and emotion about it, I don't know how that would have been. But he was incredibly supportive, and he just he was always there, willing to make the move if you know, and be accepting.
So he was ready to make the reconciliation when you were ready to go back. Wanted to see that. What about your father? You talked about in your column, you talked about your father trying to explain as he apologized.
And it was remarkable because this is a man who's not comfortable saying he's wrong about anything. But the first few times we got together, he said to me over and over again, he said, "I'm sorry I was so hard on you. It's just the way I was raised. I just didn't know any other way." And he said the same thing to Herb. He apologized to Herb.
What did Herb say?
And Herb's just like, "Look, I understand." Oh. And so, you know, I finally convinced him he didn't need to apologize. I just, you know, I don't, you know, people say, "How do you forgive that?" I'm not sure it's even about forgiveness as much as it is just letting the love you have for somebody be enough. And again, it was difficult, but any angst I had about it was gone. I just wanted, if all I'd had was that one moment at the wedding, I would have been okay. Really, just it gave me the ability to say what I wanted to say, and it was transformative.
I have only about 30 seconds left to talk about your life, your post-journalism life. What do you have planned for yourself?
I am currently teaching at UNCG and High Point University. After the first of the year, I will be a full-time adjunct at Elon University.
Your students will be very lucky to have you because you have so, so very much to teach us all. Susan Ladd,
thank you.
Thank you so much for being on our program. Susan Ladd, a journalist and educator, spent 3 decades at the Greensboro News and Record, now adjunct instructor and lecturer at High Point University and UNCG. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director at North Carolina Public Radio. It is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.